Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the court. We have one case this morning, United States v. Armstrong. Captain Rose, are you prepared to argue on behalf of appellant?
Yes, sir.
Captain Birkin, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, sir.
Very well. Please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court. May it please the court. I request 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Liljeburg mandates reversal here for three reasons. First, the military judge put her thumb on the scale. She consistently interrupted and interjected an appellant's trial to the detriment of the defense. Second, the military judge departed from judicial decorum and impartiality when she demanded that the defense counsel shut his mouth on the record. Third, the judge elicited laughter from the panel at the defense counsel's expense during a crucial part of the defense counsel's cross-examination of the victim. These actions not only hindered the defense's ability to put on a case, they cast doubt on the integrity of the proceedings as a whole. Now, I'd like to go through the Liljeburg analysis and start at Joint Appendix page 43 to 46. At this point in the record, the military judge has forgotten the defense counsel's name in front of the panel. The government has objected under MRE 412, and the defense counsel is trying to augment his response to the objection with a proffer. The 39A is called, the panel leaves, and it's just the parties and the military judge. And the military judge simply will not let the defense counsel get a word in edgewise. He can't make a proffer because the military judge has already decided in her mind that she knows where Mr. Jordan is going. So she interrupts him. She tells him to shut up. She says, I'm the military judge. When I'm talking, you shut your mouth. As they're going back and forth, out of nowhere, the military judge brings up again the fact that Mr. Jordan let her flounder, those were her words, when she couldn't remember his name in front of the panel. This is just one example of the way that the antagonism seeped through in this trial at the prejudice of appellant. After this occurs, the defense counsel requests that the military judge recuse herself. At this point, the TDS attorney recognizes there's sort of no going back from when the military judge told him to shut his mouth, told Mr. Jordan to shut his mouth. And so they motion for the military judge's recusal. And from the beginning of that motion, at the very, very beginning, it was clear that the military judge had already made up her mind on how she was going to deal with this motion. She was not going to recuse herself. So when defense counsel requests to hear evidence from a person who was in the gallery at the time of this exchange, the military judge won't hear from Ms. Langley. And Ms. Langley was a witness to the entire exchange between Mr. Jordan and the judge. She personally observed the military judge's behavior on the record, her demeanor, her affect as it pertained to Mr. Jordan, and she had relevant evidence to bring to bear on this motion for recusal. But the military judge just won't hear from her. I think it's important at this point to go back to, and I'm going to say the case name wrong here, but Cancioli is about the fact that allegations of impartiality have got to be supported by facts. There's got to be some sort of probative evidence that would warrant a reasonable inference of a lack of impartiality. So how can the defense accomplish that if they can't present evidence in support of their motion for recusal? The answer is simple. There was no possibility for fair judgment in this case because the military judge had already made up her mind. She was not.
Why wasn't the testimony of the bailiff sufficient to establish a record of the exchange and what happened?
It's insufficient, Your Honor. However, the court could have called the bailiff. The court was free to hear the testimony from Lieutenant Cavett after the defense had had an opportunity for a full hearing on the evidence that the defense wanted to present in court. So when Lieutenant Cavett was not confused about the questions being asked of him, after he admitted this was his first court-martial, he had only ever seen trials on television, he was entirely obsequious and deferential to the military judge. He was acting in that capacity under the authority of the military judge. And so while I think the military judge was completely within her right to call her own witnesses to present evidence in this motion to recuse herself, she was incorrect to prevent the defense from calling their own witnesses. And then another important part about this motion for recusal is that at no point in time does a military judge turn to the government and ask, government, what's your position on this? Do you have any witnesses that you would like to call? In fact, as soon as the defense is complete with their examination of Lieutenant Cabet, she, without any sort of deliberation or written rulings, says, I'm done here. I'm not recusing myself. And then she applies an erroneous standard. She refers to the standard as being whether a person who is unfamiliar with the case observing the proceedings would come to that conclusion. And the correct standard is any conduct which would lead a reasonable person, knowing all of the circumstances, to the conclusion that the judge's impartiality might reasonably be questioned.
Captain Rose, on that specific point, are you saying that we should give the military judge less or even no deference because of that, or do you simply say that's the error and move on to prejudice?
Your Honor, this Court should give no deference to the fact that there are this Court should give no deference to the military judge's ruling because she made no findings of fact. That is relevant to the amount of deference we give her. But
well, not all rulings in a court in a trial need to have findings of fact necessarily. But you're focused on the her articulation of the standard. So I'm just trying to get it clear in my mind. Are you suggesting that you look at that incorrect in your articulation and move right to prejudice, or we simply give her less deference, no deference, or what? Do you see, you know what I'm asking?
Yes, Judge Sparks. It is a clearly erroneous application of the law. That is the error. It is not a question of deference because we can't give deference to an erroneous standard of law. So the appellant's position is that this is a clearly erroneous misapprehension of the law under 902A, as we have applied it in cases like Uribe, Rudimenkin, and Quintanilla. And so this was, again, misapprehension, misapplication, and then we moved to Lilyberg analysis.
Okay.
Now,
then,
counsel, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. I was going to ask one more question.
No, go ahead.
Regarding your actual position, you mentioned 902A. And I guess I'm wondering, 902A questions or asks about whether or not the military judge's impartiality could be reasonably questioned. It sounds like an implied bias. And are you relying on an implied bias theory or actual bias or both? Or
the appearance of bias, Your
Honor. The appearance of bias. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Judge Sparks took half my question, but I'll go back to the front half. With regards to the articulation of the standard, granted, the military judge used but did not articulate the standard as it has been articulated in our case law, particularly Sullivan. But from a practical perspective, she said a reasonable person was unfamiliar with the case observing the proceedings. And Sullivan says, a reasonable person knowing all the circumstances. Aren't those actually the same? If you're observing the proceedings, would you not, in fact, be aware of all the circumstances? So notwithstanding the fact that she misarticulated it, is it your position that she also misapplied it?
It is a fine distinction, Your Honor. However, it is confusing the way that she applied it herself because she says, I'm not going to hear from Ms. Langley, who is not unconnected from the case. And then she turns and permits testimony from the bailiff, who most certainly is connected to the case because he is acting in a capacity under her authority. I think we cited to 10 or 15 times where the military judge instructs him, orders him to go, you know, retrieve the panel, take this document, bring back this document. And so in that sense, even the bailiff is not unconnected to the case. And Ms. Langley certainly observed all of the proceedings. And so she, you know, may not testify directly to evidence pertaining to what an objective person would think, But she could provide evidence as to what she observed throughout the entirety of the court-martial. And I think even the comparisons that she could make to the other 20-plus courts-martial that she observed would have been very relevant under the a correct, appropriate standard in 902A.
Thank you.
So under each prong of the Liljeburg analysis, we are able to establish that there has been that we've met this standard. The first is
before you get to those three prongs, can I ask one more question? So, right, the appropriate standard is knowing all the circumstances, and the audio of this whole exchange of these exchanges is in the record, and you can listen to it, and you can come away with that. I'll grant you that maybe the military judge wasn't the model of judicial decorum or temperament, but is one of the circumstances that you're supposed to know, I would say, you could come across with the impression that the Civilian Defense Counsel was also abrasive in his demeanor. Is that part of the circumstances that factors into the analysis? And if so, what do we make of that? What responsibility does the Civilian Defense Counsel have for his own demeanor in the courtroom?
Your Honor, I think courts have wrestled with this line, and especially in, like, the cases we've cited are Spears from the Seventh Circuit, Candelaria-Gonzalez, also from the Seventh Circuit. And they look at the judge's responsibility to display neutrality and disinterest. And while some of, like, particularly, like, when Mr. Jordan is going back and forth with the judge and Mr. Jordan says, you should also remember my name, that was maybe, like, not the best choice of words. The military judge, however, is in a unique position, especially when she's in front of the panel, not to, quote, lose their cool or depart from the judicial spirit required of them. And so in Spears and in Candelaria-Gonzalez, they draw a line and they say when the trial judge doesn't exhibit neutrality in their language and in their conduct in a trial, especially before a jury, that will prejudice the appellant. And so what we have here is, throughout the record, hostility, criticism of the defense counsel's performance, and we have pointed out in the record that this has happened in front of the panel. And so when you take a look at the Liljeburg factors, specifically the third prong, you would consider...
Counsel, before you get to the third prong, I'm sorry, I don't want to throw you off completely, but it goes specifically to what you just stated. The military judge provided a curative instruction. And so are you saying that clearly the curative instruction wasn't curative, that it didn't purge whatever taint to the panel? Because at this point, most of the behavior occurs in a 39A session. And so really, other than the interruptions, the only thing that occurred before the panel was the military judge forgetting forgetting the defense counsel's name. So are you saying the curative instruction was not enough?
That's exactly our position, Your Honor. So to the instruction, she instructs that the panel should disregard any comment or statement or expression made by me in the course of the trial that indicates any opinion on my part as to whether the accused is guilty or not guilty. And then she refers to having a, quote, senior moment and forgetting Mr. Jordan's name. And I think if that was the only thing that happened in the trial, we would not be here today. But right after she gives this instruction, I think within 10 or 20 minutes, is when she interrupts the defense counsel at not just any point in the cross-examination of the accused or of the complaining witness, the victim, Ms. At the most crucial part of the cross-examination. At this point, the defense counsel has elicited testimony that my client is a partial amputee, above-the-knee amputee, and is getting into the specifics of how he was able to position himself over her and pin her down with one leg, and the witness is becoming combative. And instead of instructing the witness to answer the question, the military judge chides Mr. Jordan in front of the panel moments after giving this instruction. So, no, it didn't have any curative powers. This instruction didn't have any curative powers because the military justice did the exact same thing that she said that the panel should disregard within moments of giving that instruction. And that's when she sort of bolsters the credibility of the witness by saying thank you for doing my job for me, eliciting laughter, audible laughter from the panel. And I just want to go back and point out that it's not, as we have briefed, it's not just this shut your mouth when you're talking to me or this exchange where she forgets his name. She also talks about his performance in the courtroom during voir dire when she says, quote, spare me the dramatics, Mr. Jordan. And so this is perhaps escalated by the fact that she forgot his name, but it is certainly a pattern of hostility and criticism.
Thank you. You were going to go into the third Liljeburg effect.
Yeah. When you look at the perception, an objective observer who is sitting in this courtroom and observing the military judge's demeanor towards the defense counsel and the fact that the military judge made a joke which elicited laughter from the panel, you would be concerned about the integrity of the military justice proceedings that were happening at that point. And then the fact that we had multiple people provide affidavits to the Army Court and to this court to express their concern about the conduct and the demeanor and the disrespect displayed to the defense counsel suggests that those people who are a part of society, a part of the public, they have concerns about the undermining of the military justice process proceeding. And so that's all the testimony that you have from Ms. Langley and from Captain Crichton and Major Smith. And so all of those factor into our ability to meet the third prong of Liljeburg. As to the first prong of Liljeburg, the risk of injustice, there is this argument between the government and the defense with regard to the military judge's ruling on 412. The government has objected to 412, and the defense counsel is trying to establish through a proffer that he is not intending to get into areas that are prohibited by the judge's ruling, and he simply can't make that argument. He can't get those words out because the military judge just won't hear from him. And so that is a risk of injustice under that specific MRE 412 ruling, and then there is the abuse of discretion in the judge's response to the motion for recusal. Pending any questions, Your Honor?
Further questions from the bench? Seeing none, thank you, Captain Rose. Captain Birkin.
Senior Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court. My name is Captain Alex Birkin, and I, along with my co-counsel, Colonel Christopher Burgess, represent the government. And we ask that you affirm the Army Court's decision because the military judge did not depart from impartiality, nor did she abuse her discretion by denying the motion for recusal. The military judge did nothing more than deliver an admonishment. The military judge is responsible for ensuring that a fair trial is conducted. Quintanilla describes this standard at 41. The complaints coming from appellant all arise at a time when the military judge was merely trying to govern an evidentiary hearing. This was after the civilian defense counsel, Mr. Jordan, flirted with 412, which could cause a potential mistrial. He then engaged in a speaking objection. The military judge then called for the 39A, excused the panel. At JA 46 through 47, we see the first interruption. Mr. Jordan, stop. The next page, JA 47, Mr. Jordan. Mr. Jordan then interrupted her again. Only then did the military judge say, outside of the presence of the panel, don't talk over me when I'm talking. When I'm talking, you shut up. That was after being interrupted three times. And you remember my name, Your Honor. The military judge recessed, heard the motion for recusal, and then gave a curative instruction to the panel. And that instruction was for what occurred in front of the panel, which was her forgetting Mr. Jordan's name. The civilian defense counsel, the only one present in the courtroom who is not wearing a name tape. The military judge engaged in some self-deprecation when she made that instruction. It was a senior moment. She chalked it up to that. Were some of these exchanges perhaps a little intemperate or stern? Sure. However, none of these, if we look at Leidecke for the standard for when a a judge's conduct might be determined to be so prejudicial or so biased against a party to require reversal, it just doesn't meet the standard.
Captain Berkman, let me
yes,
ask
Your Honor.
You this. You've mentioned a couple of times, and the record does in fact indicate that many of the comments were made during an Article 39A session in the absence of the members. But if the standard is to be viewed from the perspective of a member of the public, is it significant or not that even though the members weren't present for a lot of this, members of the public sitting in the courtroom were? Is that significant at all?
It is significant, Your Honor. All facts and circumstances are to be considered, not merely what happened in front of the panel. Turning to the third Liljeburg factor as well, looking at all factors and circumstances, I don't believe that a member of the public would be concerned if a military judge said, don't talk over me when I'm talking. When I'm talking, you shut up, after being interrupted three times. And also, turning to the third Liljeburg factor, looking at Uribe at 450, the public would have concerns if a fair trial was overturned on appeal merely because of some intemperate, poor words being chosen by a military judge. We're only here discussing those words. We're not here because appellant is alleging any other violations of their constitutional rights. So this was a fair trial. Of all those opining, I also, looking at the third factor, and we only get there if there is bias, which there is not. But looking at that third factor, Lieutenant Guibert's perspective is actually far more useful than any of the affidavits provided by appellant, their counsel, because the standard is an objective one. We're not looking at someone who has 20 trials experience under their belt, has seen many judges, is an expert opining. We're not concerned about their opinion. We're only concerned about what happened. And if the record didn't capture everything that happened, Lieutenant Guibert was certainly capable of describing it since he was present in the courtroom. He also, not having any prior experience in the courtroom, comes with his own objective perspective. He gave factual observations, and he said, she said she was sorry, and she admitted to making a mistake. This is also the witness. Now we have some buyer's remorse from appellant, but this was their second choice as a witness that they requested to call. So, this is not a party of the court. This is not someone under the sway of the military judge. If Lieutenant Guibert was, the defense would not have called him.
Counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, what are we to make of, as the appellant has argued, that there is an abuse of discretion because the military judge misstated the standard with regards to the whole Sullivan standard of a reasonable person knowing all the circumstances. What are we to make of that? Does that rise to the level of being clearly erroneous and so therefore is abuse of discretion?
No, Your Honor, because an erroneous view of the law did not influence the decision. While a military judge did say, nor do I think a reasonable person who is unfamiliar with the case observing the proceedings would come to that conclusion, though that is not verbatim the standard set out in Sullivan, it is still a reasonable person observing the proceedings. She failed to include that all facts and circumstances. However, the military judge also came to the correct conclusion here. And we can turn to Robertson v. State, the tipsy coachman doctrine, that even if the military judge stated incorrect standard, the conclusion was correct. This was not verbatim correct, but the military judge clearly understood the standard and applied the correct reasoning and came to the correct conclusion. And there's also facts and circumstances in this case that all the facts and circumstances support that military judge's conclusion.
And so to re-echo my brother on the bench's question with regards to the degree of deference, the fact that there are no findings of fact, there are no analysis put on the record, what should this court make of that? Should deference be granted?
Yes, Your Honor, though perhaps less deference, still deference should be granted. to the military judge's reasoning and holding. Further, turning to Leidecke, the alleged bias here, it was not extrajudicial, and bias must be extrajudicial in order for it to be disqualifying. The exception to that is unless they display a deep-seated favoritism or antagonism, that would make fair judgment impossible. And that is simply not the case here, where a military judge is admonishing a party who has interrupted her three times and forgotten his name. Forgetting someone's name has no bearing on partiality. You know, it's a lapse of memory which the military judge accounted for and apologized for. The military judge also gave a curative instruction. Panel members are presumed to follow those instructions, and there's no argument from appellant that to the contrary. The stern and ordinary efforts at courtroom and administration remain immune. Again, that's Leidecke. At worst, this case is nothing more than that. And so taken as a whole, this exchange did not violate appellant's constitutional right to an impartial judge because the court's martial legality, fairness, and impartiality were not put into doubt by the military judge's actions. That's Quintanilla at 78. Finally, the military judge did not abuse her discretion when she denied the motion for recusal. And this is an objective test, judged from the standpoint of a reasonable person observing the proceedings. A reasonable person is someone who is disinterested and free of bias. They are a hypothetically disinterested, well-informed, and thoughtful member of the public. Lieutenant Kibet certainly embodies all of those qualities. The record speaks for itself. We have no need for more thorough findings. The military judge she did say, "I was here, I know what happened," and that is completely correct. The appellant suffered no specific injustice here, even if the military judge did abuse her discretion. There is no specific injustice. The military judge allowed defense to call a witness, and as far as the military judge putting her finger on the scale, well, that whole entire exchange shows to the contrary. The military judge was persuaded by the civilian defense counsel, Mr. Jordan, to allow him to call a witness. There was some haranguing, some back and forth. She originally denied the request to call a member of his defense team to testify to her personal opinion. But the military judge eventually was persuaded by Mr. Jordan after this tense engagement, and she allowed him to call Lieutenant Kibet. And there's that was their second pick. Now, turning to the second factor.
Counsel, on that point, appellant counsel says that the bailiff was connected to the case and that there's no distinction between the bailiff and Ms. Langley. What's your response on that?
Your Honor, Ms. Langley is a paid member of the defense team. The bailiff is a lieutenant who's been assigned to bailiff duty.
He was assigned by the unit?
Yes, Your Honor. He
was he selected by trial counsel, or did trial counsel tell the unit who to select?
I may be able to supplement the record to provide that information, Your Honor, but I don't have that handy. The bailiff, though, in this case, is he's not part of the full-time staff of the military judge. He is simply in the courtroom fulfilling a temporary duty. So while he does have a responsibility to follow the judge's orders, the military judge is also the highest-ranking person in that room. So does everyone else. The bailiff also described that things got heated, and he described his facts that he observed, but the record picked all of that up. So the difference here is very stark between the bailiff and a member of the defense counsel team, the executive assistant to their expert witness, who's paid, who has an interest in the outcome in the case, and though she might have years of experience and wisdom, she only wanted to provide her opinion about how the military judge was conducting herself. But her opinion does nothing to inform us on the reasonable, the objective standard that is necessary for determining whether or not there is appearance bias in this case. So finding an abuse of discretion alone, further, if this court believes that the military judge did abuse her discretion, reversal is not warranted. Turning to Liljeburg factor two, finding an abuse of discretion alone would cause military judges to be appropriately mindful of their obligations under RCM 902. Reversal is not warranted. And the circumstances of this case also would not undermine the public's confidence in the military justice system, because at the end of the day, there was a mixed verdict.
Captain Birkin, could I go back just a little bit of what you just said? I think Liljeburg says that we test, assuming a majority of this court disagrees with you, of course.
Yes, Your Honor.
Assuming that, I'm not saying they should or would, but assuming they do for the moment, and they say that the military judge abused her discretion. That's an error, and Liljeburg says we test for harmlessness. And I guess I'm wondering, in a case like this, how do you test for harmless error here when you have basically the whole case is made up of two people, the victim and the appellant, perpetrator? How in a case like this do you test for harmlessness?
Your Honor,
and yes. It's not a trick question. I know a lot of stuff about military justice, but I don't know everything.
Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the ones that's kind of bothering me right now.
Well, I certainly don't know everything about military justice, Your Honor. So, but to answer your question, in this case here, turning to the exchange between the Civilian Defense Counsel and the judge when the victim was on the stand, that exchange, thank you for doing my job for me, that was after a pattern from the Civilian Defense Counsel of testimonial questions that were made, that were objected to, that the military judge sustained the objections. And as far as the military judge putting her finger on the scale at a crucial moment like that when a victim is testifying, Mr. Jordan at that time was saying, had this pattern of, well, that's just your testimony, but that's not what happened. Here's what happened. And that's testifying through the course of your cross-examination. The military judge had already ruled on that a couple times. Mr. Jordan continued to do it. And the victim at that point had a witty rejoinder, seeing it coming. And so the military judge said, thank you for doing my job for me, but then, Mr. Jordan, please refrain from it. It was certainly not the model thing to say. There's no question about that. However, it was brief. There's no evidence that influenced the actual outcome and prejudiced appellant. This is a mixed verdict. So, with a victim, several of the convictions were acquittals on those with a separate victim. And we have no violation of any constitutional rights alleged here that we're arguing about. This is simply the question of those statements made in the court that were just intemperate, perhaps stern at times, and, you know, at worst, indecorous. But none of it would be sufficient to grant a reversal. Hope that answers your question.
It does. Thank you.
Thank you, Judge. Finally, on the third Liljeburg factor, to conclude, the military judge did allow Lieutenant E.K. to be called. There was some haranguing, but she was persuaded by the CDC and allowed Lieutenant E.K. to be called and testify to what he heard and said. And she said she was sorry and admitted to making a mistake. Someone who's only seen court on television is much more like a member of the public, someone whose perspective we consider for the third Liljeburg factor. And Lieutenant E.K. embodies that much more than any of the affidavits submitted by the defense team, which are, you know, this is not about a letter-writing campaign. This is more about the objective person, which Lieutenant E.K. was. Given that the military judge did not depart from her impartiality and she did not abuse her discretion by denying the motion for accusal, we ask that you affirm the Army Court's decision. pending any further questions.
Any further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Captain Birkin.
Thank you.
Captain Rose.
Your Honor, I'd like to first discuss the role of the bailiff, and I'd like to go back to the rule itself, to 902D2. The language under 902D2 is that we, specific language is that the military judge can prevent the defense from calling people who are going to introduce innuendo or speculation. And there is no evidence that just because Ms. Langley was a paid professional who was working as a forensic psych assistant wouldn't be able to provide that objective evidence of what she observed in the courtroom. Again, so it's not that the bailiff or Ms. Langley are testifying to what an objective person thinks. That their evidence that they were going to offer would not be relevant to that point. The evidence that needs to be offered is what did witnesses in the gallery observe of the military judge's demeanor and the potential for displaying disrespect or antagonism against the defense counsel. And that's what the evidence was going to be elicited from Ms. Langley. And because Ms. Langley's testimony should not be disqualified under 902D2, there was no basis to prevent her from testifying in this record. I'd like to move on to talk about a little bit about the government's argument. They sort of said that that nothing here arises to more than an admonishment. That's not the case. It is a different situation where the military judge sua sponte objects to the line of questioning of the defense counsel absent a government objection. That's what makes this more than an admonishment. That's what makes this different than the situation in Litke. And then I'd just like to talk a little bit about Litke. Litke does not say or stand for the proposition that bias must be extrajudicial. Litke answers the question of can there be bias that appears present within a courtroom and the proceedings of a trial? And the answer in Litke is yes, there can be. There can be. And that's where we find there's bias when there is either deep-seated favoritism to one side or antagonism to the defense. I just want to move on to the mixed verdict because the counsel brought up the fact that there are mixed verdict. And it's important to take a step back and look at the acquittals in this case. The government presented the testimony of a witness who went first. There were two specifications of sexual assault related to that witness's testimony. For the presentation of that evidence, the military judge did not interject, interrupt, or interfere. And for that witness, the appellant was acquitted of both of the specifications. In the presentation of the second witness, after the tension between the military judge and Mr. Jordan escalated, and after the military judge put her thumb on the scale, so to speak, that is the one witness for whom appellant was acquitted. So that's how those mixed verdicts, it's different than Uribe, where there were mixed verdicts on either side, some that were rulings on objections that were in favor of the appellant and against the appellant. That's not the situation that we have here in terms of the mixed verdicts. I do see my time has expired, pending any questions.
Thank you, Captain Rose. The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning.
The court stands adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning.